Bill Buford wrote an amazing book in 1990. He was living in England at the time, and he followed a group of soccer fans of the team Manchester United. And they weren't really fans, really, so much as fanatics. Violent hooligans is what they were. And the book is about the impulse of violence. It's called Among the Thugs. And in it, Buford says he was surprised by what he learned. He says he came away with this knowledge he hadn't possessed before. And in a similar way, his best-selling book, Heat, from 2006, was about this knowledge he learned about Italian cooking. The idea for his latest book was to try and learn the secrets to French cooking. The plan was to go to Paris, to leave the family for a time, to embed himself in a great kitchen, get classical training. But the plan didn't work out that way. The family came along to live in France. 5 years they ended up there. And Buford didn't go to Paris for this knowledge. He went to Lyon. And while he did end up in a great kitchen, that's not where his training began. It began in a bakery in Lyon with a man named Bob.
I learned about Bob the first time my wife took me to an appointment to view an apartment. And on that occasion, people were talking about this great boulangerie right nearby, which served the best bread. You know, he looked a little bit like a really old mattress that someone had thrown out. Round, filthy, and always covered in wheat. Rarely shaved. Matted hair, which who knows what had been washed. And Bob's bread was actually really good. It wasn't like your, I don't know, your first seeded, deep brown, black, grainy piece of artisanal bread. It was a white flour baguette that crunched and had aromatics and had flavor. And Bob became more and more of our family because it became more and more of what we were ingesting. In the meantime, I couldn't find a restaurant to work in. I'd had a couple introductions, and they all turned to be disasters for one reason or another. And the night after attending the Bocuse d'Or, which is like the Olympics of French cooking, I realized Bob is where I got to go to work. And I went into Bob and asked him if he'd take me. And he said no. What? Bob, you make the best bread in Lyon. Why is your bread the best bread? I want to come here and learn how to make your bread. I want to give me a chance to come here and say what it is that makes good bread. And he then got excited because he does make the best bread in Lyon. He probably makes the best baguettes in the world. Showed up 3 a.m. after he said yes and discovered a place of such darkness and filth. It was just astonishing. There was a sink which is just full of coffee grinds and a roll of toilet paper had fallen into it, dirty coffee cups and plates and yesterday's sandwiches. And yet, he did produce this extraordinary, extraordinary bread. I kept quizzing him to find out, why is it so good? Is it the yeast? And he said, no. I said, is it the leavening? He lets it rise very slowly. He punches it down, he lets it rise again. He then shapes it into a baguette. And he said, no. That's like basics bread. And then I said, well, what is it? And he said, the flour. Oui, the flour. I thought, flour is flour is flour, isn't it? No. His flour came from a special place and was grown with wheat that was from a soil that hadn't been ruined. And in these sort of basic, get down to pre-revolution, pre-industrial environment of making food was probably the secret of Bob's Bread. I regarded myself in France to learn all the basics of the French kitchen, the basics of French ingredients, how to make cheese, how to make saucisson. And I wanted to get as close as I could to those basics, and dirt kept recurring. And this ended up becoming emblematic of one of the things I was trying to do in France, which is get to the wholest, truest taste of the food there, whether it's the real taste of a sauce or a real taste of a wine from a specific place or a cheese from a specific place or the bread. And it ended up really being a quest for everything that's in the dirt.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dirt is the name of Buford's new book, and he's joining us today. In the book, he says it was in a French kitchen where he had wanted to find himself for most of his adult life. So that's where we began.
I was a guy who liked to cook. For me, it was the great pleasure of using my hands and making something that didn't exist before. It's kind of the most fundamental narrative of our daily life is we gather up the ingredients and we transform them into food. I discovered France when I was living in England. And I moved to England when I was 24 years old. Stayed for almost 20 years. And I just discovered, like many, many, many millions of people before me, the wonders of French cuisine, and wanted to be able to master it, and had tried at different times and had built up a very small repertoire of ingredients, but it was no question that that was what I wanted. And then I became very intrigued by the way Dan Barber used the word. Dan Barber's the chef of Blue Hill here in New York, and a great writer and a great thinker about food. You can always tell when a cook has been French trained, and he uttered that phrase. But then I was already on my way on my journey, but he uttered that phrase and I thought, yes, that's what I want. I want that expertise. In the way, the experiences that led to the writing of Heat, I'm very comfortable making pasta. I feel really at ease making pasta. I can do pasta in very different forms. I learned it. It's a skill. I make it fresh. I prize the flour that I work with. I have a skill. And I wanted a comparable skill, but for something much more elaborate and comprehensive than just making pasta. I wanted the skills of the French kitchen. It's something I wanted in my life. And, you know, I had different phrases for it at different times, but that was probably something that I've wanted, you know, for 25 years before we ever set out for France.
You know, I've always wondered, I thought this in Heat too. Did you want to be a cook? Did you want to be a chef? Or did you want to be a writer who wrote about cooking? You know what I mean? Like, was there ever a point when you thought, you know, I could give up this writing part and actually cook? Or was the writing always connected to the cooking?
There was a loose federation, I'd say, in both enterprises. I definitely embarked on both tasks with a view of writing about becoming a different person who is somebody who cooks. And in both enterprises, both in Italy and France, I thought quite seriously about becoming a cook or chef, a patron of a restaurant or a butcher. When I got back from Italy, there was somebody who asked me if I wanted to open up a butcher shop, like a Dario Cecchini version of a butcher shop. And I enjoyed the thought. And the only reason I didn't is because I think it is so demanding. I would find it hard to write, and I don't find it easy to write to begin with. And I think I would miss that activity. In Lyon, I got tempted to open up like a pop-up restaurant. And if our own family life hadn't got so complicated as I was there with a family, then I would have. And at one point I was investigating it. in both ventures, I got carried away, and I stayed much longer than I needed to write a book. And I didn't really want to stop to have to write the book. And I kept wanting to learn more and more and more. On the other hand, I think with the France book especially, I think there's a lot of things I wouldn't have had the confidence to say, or wouldn't have had the perceptions if we hadn't stayed so long. And really, you know, it wasn't somebody who hadn't read the book said, oh, well, you know, good for your little, you know, chef, American chef holiday. There's a whole tradition of American chef holiday. And I thought, you dickhead, you haven't looked in the book. And this wasn't a holiday. We were actually, the reason why we stayed so long is that we're trying to get onto the chain where if you're there 5 years, then you get a 5-year visa. And then after that, you get a 10-year visa, and then you can apply for citizenship. So I was trying to apply for citizenship. And when we finally got to the 5-year spot, they said, oh yeah, you got to apply next year. But then we were really run out of money, and the boys couldn't read English at all, but they could read and write in French. And we were just at a spot where we had to say very sadly goodbye.
I want to ask you about, this is an important part of the book, I think. You mentioned in the book how you had gone to Lyon to learn how to cook French food. But the idea was at first you figured you would go on your own to some degree. But then when Jessica and the boys comes into the picture, the idea of going there as a family, you mentioned in the book how that changed the enterprise. This was a family thing. Talk about that if you would.
Yes, it's probably one of my failures as a parent is that I keep forgetting that I have children. And this enterprise, which began by my wife and I meeting Michelle Richard, a great flamboyant creative French chef, on a train. And then I thought, well, gosh, this is the guy I want to work with. He's so much fun. He's so ebullient. He's so not French. He's not stiff. He doesn't have his arms folded in front of his chest, which is the classic pose of a French chef. Yeah. This is my guy.
Yeah.
But that involved my commuting to Washington, D.C. while the family was here in New York. And that created a lot of stress. The high point was probably the night when my wife was phoning me over and over again. And I probably had too many glasses of Pinot Noir at the end of my shift. Eating a tuna burger at the bar, which was my habit, and staying in a hotel. It was really not a bad life. And Jessica, my wife, had the boys who had just learned how to jump out of their cribs and did that. She said she gave up after 100 times.
100 times,
and,
right.
And she's not someone who exaggerates until finally she found them just laughing away, hysterical in the kitchen, because they'd managed to open the refrigerator door and pour milk and were eating ice cream and broken eggs. And everything was all over the floor. And she wasn't happy with the arrangement we had. And in my initial plan, I'd do like a stage with Michelle Richard. I'd go to Paris. I'd work at a bistro for 3 months or something like that. And maybe I'd have to continue it a little bit longer, but everything took a little bit longer to organize. And when until finally she said, no, we're going together. And that changed everything. For a start, we had to do it legitimately. We couldn't just like slink in and slink out again with the European immigration laws. We had to get proper visas, which terrified me. And then the proper visas took all summer long to get. And then there was such a commitment to get them. And then we got an apartment because there was no like furnished apartments or no, at the time there wasn't anything except for real residents.
Yeah.
And we got committed, and then we were there as a family, and it became a family story. Didn't mean for it to be a family story. I just wanted to learn how to be a, you know, cook French, but right. it became a very profound family story. Profound for us, anyways.
Right. I want to ask you about Michelle Richard, because he's one of the great characters in the book, and also one of the important relationships for you. One of the things that interested me was you were looking for basic, as you said in the book, and he was, at least when you met him, sort of anti-basic. And he knew the classics. He had read classic books on French cuisine, but he did it, he told you, to be provoked. Talk a little bit about Richard, because he's a great character, I have to say.
I was attracted to Michel Richard because he was just unpredictable, funny, intimate, really not what you think of as a French person. What I probably wanted was like a watered-down version of Jacques Pepin. Someone would say, all right, this is how you would do a duck confit, yeah. And this is how you make a beurre blanc, and this is how you make that, all these basic dishes. What I got from Michelle was something like a dramatic illustration of what I've been seeing in my other career as a literary editor, which is the workings of a very imaginative person. And in the way that a writer, a good writer, will approach every sentence that he or she writes as an opportunity to be different. And that will then play into his or her imagination of trying to tell a story that's different and is also a story. In Michelle, it was all played out in front of me, and he would either get provoked in a way that I think writers get provoked when they read books that they like. I often saw him studying this great big tome, Ali Baba's book of French cuisine, which I now have. He would often be reading it, and it's a great book. It's a very good description of how all the dishes are made classically and seriously. He would think, what can I do different? It provoked him to go sideways. One of the dishes I like preparing, it took a long time to master it, is puff pastry, pat feuilleté. And that's butter in layers between dough that you fold over and you fold over and you fold over, so that when you cook it, the fat melts and expands and blisters the pastry, and you get this extraordinarily light tasting food that's made with nothing but the heaviest of ingredients. And so he would take something like that and he'd go, what else can I do? I know, I'm going to make it instead of butter, I'm going to use foie gras. I came to learn that there was nothing he did, not even basic pastry, sablé pastry or something like that, or a pastry for a tart, nothing he would do if he hadn't made it a little bit better. And sometimes it would take him years to make it better, and maybe he didn't quite arrive. Like a great Lyonnais dish is a pâte à yaourt, meat in a crust pastry. And Michelle, he didn't like it because he said the pastry's always damp. And so he was trying to come up with a way of reinventing pâte à croûte. And the whole time I knew him, he was doing this. He'd been working on it for years. And sadly, he died before he ever finished. Otherwise, he won't make it if it means he can't make it himself. And it was an illustration of how a creative mind works.
Bill Buford, his new book is Dirt: Adventures in Lyon as a Chef in Training, Father, and Sleuth Looking for the Secret of French Cooking. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Bill Buford is joining us to talk about his 5-plus-year adventure trying to learn the knowledge of the French kitchen. Buford wrote about Italian cooking in his best-selling book, Heat. His latest is called Dirt. It's a reference to the soil and the land in Lyon, where he ended up and settled in. Buford says everything the people in Lyon eat is grown right around them, and the farms there are organic, not for any ideological reason, but because they always were. Let's talk about Lyon. That was not the initial idea, going to Lyon. So just mention how you end up there and then give us a sense of your initial impressions. I like at one point in the book you describe it as a throwback city of wise guys and corrupt cops.
I had been to Lyon once to change buses to go skiing when I was living in England, and it was 4 a.m. I had no idea what Lyon was like. Lyon came up while I was trying to figure out where to go, and it came up in Michel Richard's kitchen at Citronelle, and a couple of chefs had worked near Lyon, and they recognized that it was a city with an extraordinary commitment to cooking, to gastronomy. Is referred to historically as the gastronomical capital of the world, which is silly, but it's a title that seems to have stuck. And as the cooks in the kitchen mentioned to me, French cooks, they said, nobody in America knows Lyon. Nobody understands it. And it is true. If anything, people think of Lyon as either a place where the cooking is heavy or somehow it's the beginning of the South. And it's actually neither. It is not a boutique city. It does not have, it has some very two fancy hotels. It is a great city. It has got a lot of beauty. It's got two rivers, the Rhone and the Saone. It has a great commitment to playing with light and light off the river. And it's got old buildings, and it's got these great Renaissance edifices and gardens and villas. But it's a gritty city. It doesn't like tourists. It doesn't like visitors. It believes that any visitor, including visitors from Paris and the city, loathes Parisians. Don't get the city. They judge the city. It's dirty. You can never, if you walk in the city, you can never take your eyes off your feet. Otherwise, you will walk into dog.
Right.
It's got prostitutes. It's got guys doing deals. It's, and there's a kind of, especially when you get outside the city and some of the other towns outside of Lyon, there's a kind of male, unshaven, cigarette smoking roughness, crudeness that seems to hark back again to, you know, like post-war France. Very crude way of being with women, and it's rough. It's in your face. Every year there were several deaths in the Saone of drownings or drunkenness. The drunkenness on a Friday and Saturday night was just phenomenal, just extraordinary. It's a rough city.
Yeah.
But in all that, it had an authenticity. It wasn't anything except what it was. And it was really confident about what it was, and it liked it. And we came to love it.
One of the things you mentioned was that there are these, I don't know, centuries of traditions connected to the countryside. I mean, that seemed to be, I don't know, that seemed to be for me a kind of theme to the book, the relationship with Lyon and the countryside, I guess.
Well, there's one famous Lyonnais, Henri Béraud, who was actually the son of a boulanger and who wrote well about Lyon. But he, like Lyon, was also not easy to take. He became a fascist and an anti-Semite and was sentenced to death at the end of the war. But he describes Lyon as the only metropolis in France that doesn't have access to the sea. And it's an old city. It has access via rivers, but even then, it's a long, long trek before you get to the sea. And its relationship really is to all the countryside around it. That countryside for centuries has included some of the best wines made in France. To the north, you have Beaujolais. Above that, you have Burgundy. In the mountains, you have Savoie. Going south, you have the northern Rhone, Côte Rôti. Further south, you have Saint-Joseph, for Hermitage. Further south, you have the Châteauneuf. But even by then, you're already getting past Lyon, because Lyon doesn't need, I think it's 75 kilometers historically. Anything that you can travel reasonably, able to travel in a day or two with a horse, is what is deemed as local. And if you set out like a 50, 75 kilometer circumference around Lyon, you have the place where the brochet comes from, the big fish. You can get the lake fish, you get the pigs, you get birds, you get ducks. It's the passageway of all the ducks coming down. You've also got these amazingly great wines, and it's the country feeds into the city, and the heart of the cuisine that developed there is a cuisine that uses those ingredients, with exceptions, but mainly it uses those ingredients, and that's what Lyonnais cooking is. It's actually very Italian.
Well, I just wanted to get to that as a matter of fact, because one of the things that that you get at in the book, and I wanted to sort of talk to you about the differences that you saw between Italian food or Italian people and the French. But Dorothy Hamilton said France is not Italy. And one of the things you had mentioned is the Italian approach being soulful, where you get your hands dirty, but the French is entirely different. So how did you describe sort of dealing with the differences or explaining the differences and maybe even appreciating, as you, I know you did, the differences?
Well, I think Italian food is soulful, and it is messy, and it's not fussy, and it's actually quite rustic.
Yeah.
And there is great relief and directness and immediacy in eating Italian food and making it. Italian food, the world loves Italian food. It just has this transparency that is very appealing, and it classically combines large elements of starch, which is, say, pasta, fat, which is almost every Italian dish has cheese, and protein, often in very limited quantities, but protein. And it's just, it delivers. In fact, you know, Italian food wasn't like that. In the Renaissance, when Italian food had its heyday, it was exactly the opposite. I mean, pasta was made then, but there is a commitment to elaboration and festa and technique, which has been lost. And that is really what the French ended up taking from the Italian Renaissance, which became the foundations of French cooking. French cooking, you know, there's precision to the French cooking, and there's a precision in what you taste. There's a precision in mouthful. There's awareness of presentation and flavor, big commitment to flavor. And almost more than anything else, to the mealtime. When you go to France, when you go to Lyon, I don't know if Paris is like this. We almost never got to Paris. But there's a commitment to the meal as like the most, one of the most important events of your day. And you don't, at least when we were there, you don't eat walking. You don't eat standing up. You don't get some takeaway food and eat it while you're on your way to someplace. There was one episode I watched where a woman was eating something and she got really hungry and she got self-conscious because she could see that people were looking at her. And in fact, one man laughed at her and then she kind of went around a corner and ate by herself. It's really socially discouraged to do anything except eat at the table. When you eat at the table, you're not distracted. You are committed to eating your food. I mean, it's probably changed, but when we were there, nobody would even look at their phones when you ate. And it was a perfectly laudable thing to eat by yourself, and you pay attention to your food.
Well, wouldn't the boys were discouraged when they went to school and would have lunch? They were discouraged from talking to each other. You mentioned they would.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, because that was a very important thing. Like, food is serious.
Yeah,
and they didn't have to eat everything, but if they wanted to eat the next course, they had to finish their first course, and their meals were always three courses, if not four. And there was always a starter. It was often very sophisticated. There was always a main dish with a sauce, always a sauce.
Yeah.
Almost never repeated. A dessert, and sometimes cheese as well. Always a dairy product.
So it's not a rigidity. I suppose I think that's the initial impression, that there's somehow a rigidity to the French approach. But you've said you've come around to understanding it in a deeper way, I guess.
There's a deliberateness.
Yeah.
And there's an order. There's a belief, actually, that French food is French culture. And so when you eat, you're actually sort of participating in your Frenchness. I think part of that was also a French formality that you have socially and a sense of people being inaccessible. And that kind of goes hand in hand with the food. There's just an order to things. And I think just like I felt I ended up connecting to the people in ways that I wouldn't have connected to in the first by just being there a year, I kind of connected to understanding what this food was about and what it represented.
Talk about Bill Buford, if you would. You finally land a chance at an important restaurant, Le Meilleur Pâtissier in Lyon. And you talk about the sort of intensity of the experience, of the culture. Would you give us a sense of that, if you would, first? Because the physical activity seems, I don't know, to me it was striking.
It was very physical. I was accepted as a stagiaire at Le Meilleur Pâtissier, which is a great established kitchen that was run by the famous La Meilleure Pâtissier, and then she died, and then a niece took it over, and then another generation took it over, and then it finally enclosed in. It had just been reopened, and it was all of Lyon celebrated the fact that this great restaurant had been reopened. But the money was tight, and everybody there was pushed very hard. And it is true, it was just crazy physical. We started at 8 a.m. We finished generally by 11:30 or midnight, except on Friday nights. It was only open Monday to Friday. And Friday nights, it could be 1 to 2, unless you're in the pastry kitchen, then it was it much later. There was a little afternoon break. Some people didn't take it because of the work they had to get through. The only time I didn't take it was when I accidentally broke a soup spoon. And Maître Vianney was so apoplectic that I could have broken a spoon that I spent a whole afternoon trying to replace it before I realized it was a very, very specialist line that you can only order directly. And And we did that too. My wife helped me do that, and then it arrived. He never told me, and I was in anguish waiting as he got his spoon back. Unlike most kitchens, there wasn't a prep kitchen. You did the prep, you did the cooking, you did the service, you did your cleanup, and then you started on the prep for later in the week, and then you started for the prep on the service, and then you did it again. I love the integrity of that, that it was much closer to real cooking, and there was no... It was kind of like non-hierarchical in some ways. Everybody had to do the cleanup. Yes, if you're a stagiaire, you get the worst of it, and I did. It was wildly physical. There's a changing room, which is upstairs near the pantry, and there's this tiny, tiny little locker, and you all got to crush in there. And I was always just so often the last person out that I would rush up there and try to get out of my clothes before people got up, and I was still the last person out. But I remember there was a day when I was there changing my clothes in the pantry so I wouldn't get boxed in by the locker room, and everybody came and go, "Ah, voila, la planche de bile. My belly, it's got smaller." And they all came and poked it and go, "Hey, well done, you're losing weight." And when you arrived here, you were like Santa Claus. But now look at that, wow. And they all each cook one after the other came and poked me in the stomach to confirm that was just from the work. The work was extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, it's also there was a darker part of that culture. Something you describe as the toxins of that workplace. There's a young man, I think he's 15 years old, who comes, has these aspirations to be a chef, and he sort of absorbs or takes on the kind of uglier side of the culture of the kitchen. Say something about that, if you would.
That was poor Mathieu. Yeah. There was three Mathieus in the restaurant, and he was the youngest. The eldest was the owner of the restaurant. And it was an experiment to take someone from the lycée, the school system where you could do a limited stage for like 6 weeks. And because he was 15, he was meant to leave at 10 p.m. in the evening. And for all the people in the kitchen, it was like a new prey. They played pranks on him, and they on Fridays they'd say, "Oh, Mathieu, this is the day that you're meant to give cookies to the chef," or something like that. "Or you got to give biscuits to the chef. You got to go quick. Where are they? Why don't you have them? Why don't you go? Oh, I don't know. Well, you got to go get them. You got to go get them. You got to rush out. Go get them. Then go quick, but you can't be gone. So you got to be gone back in 5 minutes. Quick, you're late. You're late. Go, come on, give them to the chef." And the chef would get these things and go, "What the fuck is this?" and they would do that all day long to him until finally he turned nasty.
Yeah.
It was like a Petri dish. Like, you know, here's a perfectly clean, you know, biological specimen, and you drop in a bit of toxin and then watch him change. Yeah. And in fact, on the day he got thrown up against a wall, he'd criticize me. And that was fine. You know, like, you know, who left my sink like this? And then Sylvain, who was a man who had a little trouble containing his feelings, lifted him by the throat, pinned him against the door, raised his big old fist, and said, "I can't help it. I have got to hit you in the face. I hate your face. I hate your face. I've got to hit you in the face." And he pulled back his fist, and it was like his big muscular arms rippled, and he was just about to do it. He said, "Oh, I got to hit you in the face." The whole kitchen stopped to watch them. Poor Mathieu said, "Why do you hate my face?" He said, "Oh, I don't know." And then he dropped him like that. But it got rougher than that. It got rough.
Yeah.
I sometimes thought of it as prison conditions.
Yeah.
There was a woman in the kitchen finally, and she did not have a nice time either. It's one of the ironies is that it was all men. They're all about 30. They all had great work experience. They all had really good skills. They're all cramped. They're all overworked. And it felt like being in a prison. And the hours, Monday, people were really, really positive. Tuesday, they were, you know, flagging. And by Thursday, just bad stuff happened. Mm. People get hurt. Just bad stuff happened.
Well, it brings up the for me, the Sylvain, the word and the idea of rigueur. That seemed like a concept, the idea of what, basically sucking it up, having fortitude or something. It seemed like an important concept in the kitchen.
You heard the word a lot. I heard it first from Mathieu Vianney when I was late because I had root canal surgery and had left a message. And it said, "Well, you know, you're either with us or you're not. Le rigueur." and it was still Vaughn's big thing. I mean, so yeah, but you worked hard and you used up a lot of calories, and he would often not eat lunch. He'd have an espresso for lunch, and that was because he was just trying to keep himself completely contained. You had it in the way you stood. You had it in your approach to your cutting board, in your hand movements. You had it in your use of the knife. You had it in your ability to do whatever you were asked to do. It's kind of military, really. I mean, it's straight military, but it's, you know, it's not an Italian idea, that's for sure.
Yeah, right. When did you know, Bill Buford, that it was time to leave?
Well, we didn't want to leave. We'd been there 4 years, and my children really were losing their English. They were becoming delightful Frenchmen. They're on their way to being Frenchmen. Yeah. And we had the idea that we could go back to the United States and put them in a school. We had to put them in a bilingual school, because no American public school would take them because they couldn't read at that age. And we had 1 year where we tried to be in both places. That was the fifth year. And that was in large part because we were trying to get the fifth year visa on our passports, which would put us on a course to getting French citizenship. My wife's still astonished by it, but I was ready to make France our home. But it just finally became too difficult. We had a co-op apartment in New York, and we're paying co-op fees and weren't allowed to rent it. And the money just got tight, and the boys needed to discover the rest of their lives. They had a very hard first year after being surrounded by Lyonnais friends. And when we went back, which we did just after like 3 weeks after we were there, the Lyonnais didn't understand why we were back. And they decided that we'd changed our minds and we'd given up on New York. And the boys, first thing we did when we got back from the airport was they rushed to the gates of the school. The school always let out at a specific time, and they knew they had 5 minutes. And while we were waiting for the gates to open, the mothers started weeping and said, "Oh, I knew you'd come back. Jessica, she's so boss. I knew she'd do it. She brought you back." Oh, no. We had to tell her not back. And we did. And then we invited everyone over for dinner. It was all mothers. And it was a very rare thing for women to go out without their men. It's a very old-fashioned city, but it was an amazing night. The night we call it in our family parlance, the night that the mothers went wild.
Bill Buford, his new book is called Dirt. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Bill Buford. We're talking about his new book, Dirt. I want to ask you about this book, The Physiology of Taste. It's a book that you mentioned early on in this book about reading, or trying to read, a number of times. You would read it in your office, your windowless office in the building for the New Yorker. But it comes to be an important book, at least in the story and in your life. Talk a little bit about this book, if you would.
This is Briat Savarin, and it's regarded as the first seminal work about food that doesn't actually have any recipes. It's about thinking about food. Yeah. And as an editor, I couldn't help but observe that the first half of the book is really overwritten and really tedious. He wrote it, I think, decades it took him, and he would go everywhere with this manuscript, and you'd be the guest of some, you know, flibbity-gibbet aristocratic butterfly, and he'd be there at the breakfast table writing another chapter. But by the end, it does achieve a kind of clarity. And there was one scene in particular, which is a visit to a monastery. Briat Savarin was a member of an orchestra ensemble and a choir, and they hike from the town of Belley, which is a good hike up into the mountains. And he describes a visit to the monastery, which is not just it's not religious, it's not even agrarian. It's a place that's wholly committed to food, that produces its own food, cooks its own food, makes its own food, makes its own drink. And it is a depiction of centuries of know-how. in the ironic context that when he made this hike, which I think was like 1782,
yeah,
it was before the French Revolution. And after the French Revolution, all those monasteries, and when the book was finished after the French Revolution, all those monasteries were destroyed. And I liked the pathos. I liked the clarity of the imagery. I liked the beauty of what he was describing. And I liked the historical irony that what he's describing is no longer available. And it's like a lot of food culture. It has to be passed on from generation to generation. It has to be taught. We are all, as human beings, we have to eat, but eating is like is on the level of an instinct. It's a necessity of survival. But we're not born knowing how to cook. We have to be taught how to cook. And that was what I found implicit in that recollection, is the importance of transmission, or what they say in French, transmettre, to hand over from one generation to the next how to make food, and that in that transmission is a sense of culture.
Yeah, you should mention, Bill, you did this walk yourself.
Yes. So it was always my endeavor to replicate the walk, and I kept putting it off and kept putting it off and kept putting it off. And then actually, it wasn't until we left that I then went back to do the walk, and did it by myself, and had all the intensity of experience that you do when you do a solitary journey. There was nobody else on the trail at all, ever. There is a road now that goes up to this plateau, and so people just did the road. And I, as much as I could, I think I followed what probably would have been the trail that he followed, because it kind of followed the waterfall and a stream up into it. Yeah, it was on the map. It was listed as a monument. It was the local village had it as a place of interest, and I hadn't been to that many ruins, and I was, you know, I didn't bring that much water with me because I was confident I'd get some water when I was up there, and only to discover that the ruin had been ransacked and buried. It was buried under, 200 years of dirt. That word again.
Yeah.
And there was a guest house at the beginning of the property that someone had unearthed, but it was gone, and somehow that was just not what I was expecting. And in its place, in this, someone was using the property to keep his bulls. He had young, very frisky bulls. It was in fact like a bullpen, and there was an electric fence going around it. And I had to find a spot to go under the electric fence because I wanted to get up to where the place was. I'd come all this way, and I did get challenged by one.
Yeah, you did.
Bull.
Yeah. Say something about the sandwich.
Ah, best sandwich I've ever had in my life. Absolutely stunning chicken sandwich made from a poulet de Bresse. The great chickens of France had been roasted in this little old-fashioned hotel where I was staying. And the cooking was sensational, and the rooms were appalling. And the owners, an older couple, they would eat dinner themselves, watching the news at the end of the night. And I said I could really use it with a sandwich for the next day. And she made me this fabulous roasted chicken sandwich, which was just full of flavor and aromatics and sustenance, and it was really good.
You write about your interest in old secondhand cookbooks. Started collecting them, I think it was after meeting Michel Richard. You like the used ones. You describe them as having this almost addictive pleasure, I think you say, in flipping through them. They have this kind of aura to them. What is it about those old cookbooks that you like, the fact that they're used?
Well, you can get the new books, or you can get like the fine editions. And there's certain classic French books that if you have your first editions, they're thousands of dollars. But what I discovered, not so much on the bookstalls in Lyon, because they're selling to visitors as much as locals, and their prices are pretty expensive. When I went to eBay France, I discovered this just trove of old books. And, you know, one of the traditions of Lyon is the cooking of the mère, the mothers. And there was a classic case of some guy who found a mère cookbook written out in this impeccable hand, and it had all the classically edited recipes, but written out in probably 1870. Mm-hmm. And he published it as a book. And I was kind of informed by his practice that you will find treasures there. And I did find treasures. And these books would be tattered and written on, and they were kind of like they were probably more important than the household Bible. And you'd find postcards in them and letters. There'd be letters to sons in the war. There'd be letters to generals. There'd be death. And they became this kind of indirect testament to what was going on in a home. A lot of them were done in World War One. That was partly an historical coincidence and partly born out of necessity, a little bit like the situation we're in now, where they didn't really have rations. They just didn't have what you needed. And so they were books that arose out of the necessity of making a meal while dealing with the depravities of the war. And they're full of pathos and tenderness and a need to cook. And actually, it's something I've thought of again recently, because at least here in New York during this time of quarantine and being in our places at home, sheltering in place, there's a big interest in my son, who likes cooking pastry, discovered that everybody's cooking desserts right now. And he found like one brownie mix when he went there, and like all the sugars had run out. To the extent that it's symptomatic of what's going on elsewhere, if you're cooking at home, you want a treat, and you want something special. You want to introduce a kind of brightness in a time of hardship. And almost all of these books, the ones that are organized by subject, they begin with dessert. They have all kinds of things for making soups, for making, I'm looking at one right now. It's like, this is a dessert. This one is a gâteau for la mie de pain. So this is a butter bread that she makes a gâteau out with milk and eggs and sugar and rum and bread. All things that they should be able to get. Or here's another one. This is a savory one, tarte aux oignons. But most of them, I just happen to have a bunch here at my desk. They begin with dessert. They're tiny little books. And you open them up and the kitchen empties out. And then you realize the kitchen is the room of the family. That's where you make food and you're fed. And you're making food from what you've learned from someone else. And in the best cases, you're passing it on to your children. I had one book where it was three generations of women. But I just found, I still find, I mean, I'm touching them. I happen to have them here on my desk in a bag, and I'm touching them, and they're just full of, they're just so intimate.
Well, you mentioned in the book that it's this recognition that cuisine, this is how you put it, protects us in our humanity.
Yes. And that particularly was in reference to an extraordinary book that I found. I think I actually have that here too, which is a book that was bound with a piece of old-fashioned red and white string, folded paper meticulously underlined, that was kept by a French prisoner of war. Mm-hmm. And in here, I found something a little bit like the Briat Saffron walk to the monastery, is that both parties are trying to recall a connection to a culture of eating and drinking and making food that is on the verge of perishing. In one case, it's a thousand-year history of a monastery and everything they've learned from working with the dirt around them. And in this other case, it's of a Frenchman who was probably arrested when the Germans crossed the border to invade France and was therefore in the camp until the war ended or until he died. I haven't been able to determine his identity yet. And the world is a dark place at that moment, and everything that food represented, which is dinner, but it's also so much more than dinner, is on the verge of being lost. And his effort is kind of a desperate one to make a record of what that food was. It's different from these World War One cookbooks of women trying to make dinner. So there's a lot of that culture there. This is actually quite desperate. And it's as many dishes that he can think of evoking Frenchness. And it begins, the first chapter, with dessert. First chapter is gâteau. The next chapter is soufflé. The next chapter are sauces. And then you get into the more savory dishes. And I can still I can still smell it. It smells of kind of age and dirt and old paper.
Bill Buford, his new book is Dirt, Adventures in Lyon as a Chef in Training, Father, and Sleuth Looking for the Secret of French Cooking. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tue, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.